Okay. All right. Power saving. Okay, great. So welcome to this lecture on the synchronous model of computation. So we'll try to go fast. Please interrupt me if you have any questions. I'm leaving for LA right after this lecture, so unfortunately I won't be able to do the 5 to 6 p.m. Discussion. But feel free, send me email. My email is, or we can do it another week if you feel it's worth doing it. Otherwise, just come see me, send me email. I'm sitting at the DOP Center, so if you have any questions, I'd be happy to discuss them with you. Okay, so you've seen a few models of computation already. And there's really many different models, languages, modeling tools, modeling environments that fall under, you know, what we can call the synchronous model of computation. I try to go back and look into many of them, and really what I think is the single characteristic that unifies all these models is the notion of a synchronous round, right? So this is what characterizes a synchronous model of computation. It has some notion of synchronous round. What does it mean? There is a beginning, clearly identifying beginning of a round. Something happens within a round. You can call it synchronous cycle. Some people call it synchronous step, synchronous reaction. So there are many names out there. There's a beginning of it, there's something that's happening in between, and there's an end, and then the next one comes, and the next one, and the next one, and so on and so forth. Okay, so we'll see examples of that. Most of them are concurrent, so most of these languages have some notion of concurrency, so there are many processes that interact, but still there is a global synchronous round that is valid for all of them. Determinism, which is very important. What does it mean? It means if you give to the system the same sequence of inputs, sequence meaning from round to round, you will observe the same sequence of outputs, okay, despite concurrency. And this is something this is an important feature of synchronous models, or an important property of synchronous models, because in contrast to other concurrent models, for instance, thread-based concurrent models of computation, which are non-deterministic, right? So you know that if you have parallel threads, the results that you will get in the end generally depend on interleaving. Right? Which thread goes faster, which thread goes first, which thread goes second. This is not the case here. There are asynchronous concurrent models of computation that also preserve determinism, by the way. And this is the case of CAN process networks. I don't know if you've seen them already. But if you have, you will know that CAN process networks communicate through FIFO queues, and they are deterministic in the sense that the same inputs result in the same output independently of interleaving in that case. So in the synchronous model, there is no interleaving, there is a notion of synchronous round, and determinism is ensured in that way. So the synchronous round, again, so there is a notion of logical time here, which I call round. So this is the logical time axis, and there is a beginning of a synchronous round or cycle. You read the external input, if any, perform some computation, produce some outputs, write those outputs to your environment, and the synchronous round finishes and the new one begins. And you do the same thing over and over again in an infinite sequence of rounds. So for example, this is an abstraction of many models you will see in real life, like Simulink, SCADE, and so on. I call it synchronous block diagram. So there are three blocks, A, B, and C, that are connected in some way. And at each synchronous round, you will fire A first, read the external inputs, produce the outputs of A, which are then fed into B and C. So then you can fire B and produce the external output. You can also fire C and produce the second external output, or you could fire C first and B later, or you can fire them concurrently, right? So you can execute B and C in parallel if you have an execution platform that supports this. Notice that you still need to execute A before B and C, because in a given synchronous round, the input of B is produced by A, right? So you still need to execute A before B calls. Is that clear? Okay, so here you have a feature of deterministic, here you have an illustration of deterministic concurrency. No matter in what order you execute B and C, you will still get the same results in the end, because of the way the model is set up. Okay? So, who can read this diagram? Yes. So tell us what does it say?
This takes an input signal, factors it by a third, and then takes two delayed samples, factors by a third, and adds them together. So it's a low-pass filter, essentially.
Right. Right. So is this a synchronous model? In what sense? Why am I putting it here? Right, you have a sense of delay. Is there a notion of synchronous round in this model? What is the synchronous round? It's this n here, right? So you have a sequence. You have a sequence of inputs. 1, 2, x1, x2, x3, x4, right? And a sequence of outputs. So this is the round. At every round, you read an input and you produce an output. And how do you do that? Well, it's specified in the diagram. Like Jeff said, if I want to write it as an equation, I would say, you know, that the output at round n is equal to the input at round n multiplied by 1/3, and to the input at round n minus 1, so the previous round, multiplied plus, you know, the input at 2 rounds ago multiplied by 1/3. Right? So that's again a synchronous system. And the notation z minus 1 here denotes, you know, a memory element basically, which stores its input at round n and produces it at its output at round n plus 1. So there is some initialization that you have to do here for the initial byte. So what is this? It's a circuit, right? So it has a register, flip-flops, and it has gates, so it's a counter. So again, this is a synchronous model, right? Why? Because there's a clock, so the, say, the upper edge of the clock determines the beginning of a synchronous round. What about this? So this is a program, a sequential program in pseudocode, right? So you initialize some state, and then you go into an infinite loop while true do something. So what do? You read your inputs, compute your outputs, and your new state, you update your state, you write the outputs, and you go back and repeat. Okay, so is this a synchronous model? Where is the round? Every time I come here is a new round. Right? So every time I start the loop is a new round. Now, maybe I write it a bit differently. Maybe I don't just go and spin and compute as fast as I can, reading my inputs as fast as I can, which was the case in the previous program. Maybe I'm waiting for some interrupt from a clock. Maybe I want to do this periodically, right, every 100 milliseconds or something. So again, I will have a notion of synchronous round every time I cross this statement, a new round begins. So these were just some examples, you know, to see that there are really multiple models that we can think of them conceptually as synchronous, right? And it may be hardware, it may be software, it may be just a model that we don't know yet how it's implemented, like the synchronous block diagram. So is this an important model of computation? What is your opinion? Is it just theoretically nice and beautiful, or does it have any practical value?
Yeah, it's very important. It's
why?
Especially digital circuits.
Right. So it's very important. It's very important. It's very widespread, both in terms of tools and models and languages, and in terms of applications. So you already mentioned one. Synchronous circuits is one application. Any other? So control software, right? So this is a number that I just came up with. I don't take it for granted. It may be 100%. One can say that, you know, all control software in some sense has this control loop. So in some sense it is synchronous. I would claim that. But anyway, a very large proportion of control software. So, you know, automotive control, nuclear, avionics, what have you, is essentially implementing a synchronous model of computation. And there are other applications as well, perhaps not as widespread. Okay, so that's the picture of hardware and software plus and things plus. So this is who knows what this is. This is Simulink, right? So this is a very important tool, very widespread tool. So it allows you to build block diagrams, so the hierarchy. And this is very much used both for software. Well, first of all, for modeling and simulation, right? That is primary use. But more and more for code generation as well. So people use this in some sense as a programming language, right? And that's the vision in some sense, that what we think of today as modeling languages, in X years from now they will really be, you know, programming languages. Just in the same way that in the past people were programming in assembly, and today they are having much more high level programming languages to program with. Well, again, this is a domain-specific programming language that is very good for the things that it is designed to do. So more and more people are using this to generate code automatically that then runs on your car, for instance, but also to generate hardware. So there's new tools that can take Simulink and produce, you know, Verilog or for FPGAs or for ASIC design and so on. Okay, so it's important in terms of applications. It's also important in terms of languages. So you have a bunch of modeling languages that abide to the synchronous model of computation, and we'll see some of them in this lecture. Now, before seeing going into these languages in a little bit more detail, I would like also to tell you about some myths that you will maybe often hear, especially if you start doing research in this field about synchronous models. Maybe not so much today, but they used to be very widespread a while back. And one of these myths says that synchronous models have zero time semantics. So this is not really true. Synchronous models are essentially untimed, right? So there is this notion of synchronous cycle, but there is no quantitative delay associated with it usually. We'd like to think of it as at least conceptually, as a sequence of rounds without assigning a priori any delay. How long does a round take? How often? It may not even be periodic, right? So you may have a system which is activated by some trigger, by some sporadic event that comes once in a while. It's still a synchronous system. There is still a notion of round. It's not a periodically activated system. So this is illustrated by this SRL program. So SRL is one of the synchronous languages. We'll see some examples of programs in SRL. So this one says every 1,000 milliseconds do emit seconds. And okay, so this is an SRL program that reads as input an event, a signal. An input event, okay, milliseconds, and produces an output event second. And it's a counter, basically. It counts every 1,000 input events, it emits one output event. So this, you can say, is a timed model, because you associate in your mind milliseconds with a timer, but it could very well be millimeters. You know, every 1,000 millimeters do emit a meter, and then it counts something else. So it's an event that's not necessarily associated with time. So that's what this says here. So you can have both time triggered and event triggered systems, and you can think of them both as synchronous systems. So back to our program, this could be a weighted clock tick or any other interrupt. That's not necessarily periodic or time-based. Now, having said that, you still could associate real time with your synchronous route. So you can say, you know, there is a first round corresponds to the tick of the clock, time one, time two, time three, in which case you have a discrete time semantic. And then you can think of this discrete time semantics as an abstraction of real time. So you can go and implement your synchronous circuit and then start worrying about the delay of your clock. So how fast can I make my circuit? Is, you know, the timing delay of the combinational logic small enough to afford a period of X? So this is very useful to first design your circuit independently from real time considerations, and then go on and, you know, try to squeeze everything and achieve the throughput that you're trying to achieve. Same thing with software. So you can first design your control loop and then try to see how often, with what period, can you execute this program, in which case you will do a what is called worst case execution time analysis. You will try to estimate what is the worst case, how much time, how many clock cycles in the worst case can this piece of code take to execute. And if this time is smaller than your period, then you can execute this program without trouble. Otherwise, you have to do something about it. But again, initially when you design your program, you don't want to think about these implementation considerations. You have other things to worry about, like how do I design my algorithm, assuming that I have enough resources, right? So how do I design a correct system even if I ignore the resource problem? And then I have to. So I'm sure Alberto has talked to you about orthogonalization of concerns. So this is one instance of that. And because of this first myth that synchronous models are zero-time semantic, people say or said, yes, they are great, but they are useless because you can't implement them, right? You cannot have zero time in practice. Zero time does not exist. Well, but this is false. This is a fallacy. Of course, synchronous models are implementable, and there are multiple examples. It's just that you are reasoning in two different levels of abstraction, one which is untimed, and then you go worry about how to implement them. Okay, so to summarize, they are good and they are deterministic, easier to understand and often easier to verify. So are people here taking the verification class of Sanjit Sesia? Why do you think synchronous models are easier to verify? Those perhaps who take the class. So the clue is the determinism, right? So here's the answer. I don't know if you can see this. Suppose I have two processes that execute concurrently, right? So process one has two states, A, B. Process two has another two states, C, D. Process one can go from A to B. Process two can go from C to D. Okay? So if I have a synchronous model of computation, I think of them as moving simultaneously, right? So concurrently they go from here, from that product state to that product state. So when I compose my system, you know, I'm trying to verify, I'm trying to check that all possible reachable states satisfy some properties, I will build this product automaton, and then I have to explore all the states of this guy. Okay? Now, if I have an asynchronous composition, if I think of this as threads that executing any possible interleaving, then what can happen, I start from here, then either the first thread moves or the second thread moves, and then the first, or the first and then the second, right? So what you observe here is that suddenly, for the same system, if I compose it asynchronously, I end up with four states. If I compose it synchronously, I end up with two states. Now you can imagine, right, if this had 100 transitions and this had 100 transitions, that would be a really big state space, whereas this one would still be manifold. So this is not to say that synchronous models, verification for synchronous models is easy. It's not. You still have the state explosion problem there. Still these state spaces get huge for real circuits. So you still have a lot of problems doing verification for these models, but it's easier at least than doing it in the totally asynchronous case. Okay. So they are deterministic, they're more lightweight, so less state explosion than asynchronous models. And they admit simpler software implementations, so often you don't require an operating system, you just have this control loop that periodically or event-triggered way does something. So you don't have scheduling problems to worry about. There's just a single process that runs on your system and that's it. And you often have simple worst-case execution time analysis to do also. So in such a code here, you will often see that there are no loops inside here. There may be if-then-elses, but there are no loops. So this is, in the end, the number of paths in this program is finite. So you can potentially go and explore all of them and find the real worst-case execution time of your system. Whereas in general, for general programs with loops, of course, worst-case execution time is undecidable, right? If you could identify the worst-case execution time of a program, you could solve the undecidability. You could solve the halving problem question. You could decide whether your program terminates or not. And that, of course, you cannot do this in practice. You cannot do this. This is an undecidable problem. Okay, so in the time that we have left, I want to go through some of synchronous models that are there to give you a better feel of you know, some examples. And I structured this in three parts. Single rate synchronous models where there everybody fires at every process in the model, if you want, fires at every synchronous cycle. Multi-rate model where some processes may fire sometimes and others at other times. So not every process fires at every cycle. And then we look at some questions of feedback and causality, which have bothered people that do research in this community for a very long time. And there are some interesting problems and interesting solutions there. Okay, so single rate synchronous models. So who can read this? Everyone should be able to read this. So I want someone to tell me what is this thing. I mean, it's a Moore machine, but okay, what is it? What does it have? Anyone? Jeff?
Set a model of finite state machines.
Okay. So what are the states?
2, 0, 2, 1, 2, 3.
So there's a finite set of states, right? There's four of them. Okay.
The guards are Z, X, or those pairs you're seeing at on each of the.
So these guards, what are they?
Boolean expressions or conditions on inputs.
They are inputs, right. So there's an initial state, and there is input. So there is a notion of input symbols. X, Y, and Z are the inputs. Okay. What else?
So the output, this is not how I'm used to seeing it. I'm assuming that A, B, and C are outputs.
Correct. There is the output. Why did you say that you're not used in seeing it that way?
The notation I've seen before is the guard and then slash the output.
Okay. So what is that?
That's the Moore machine.
Okay. Good. That's coming. So this is the Moore machine now. In the Moore machine, it's the states that are annotated with outputs, not the transition. Why? So there is an output function.
The output function is only a function of the state.
Right.
Not the state.
Correct. So it's a function, call it out, that takes a state and gives you an output for that state. So every state has an output, and that's what it says. Right. So at state Q0, I output B. At state Q1, I output A. And then there is a transition function, right? Let's call it next, that takes a state and takes an input and tell you what your next state will be at the next round. Right? So here, if I am at Q0 and if I see input Z, then I will be the next time at Q1. If I see X or Y, I will be at Q3. So where is the synchronous round here? It's the transition, right? So, or the state, if you want. So, state one, I'm first round, state two, second round, third round, fourth round, and so on. And notice that this is a deterministic machine by definition. So these are functions, right? So for every state and for every input, I have a unique next state. And for every state, I have a unique output. So this is how I would look at this as a circuit, right? So I have my state in one or more latches, you know, flip-flops, stored in one or more flip-flops. I have my next function, which takes my current state and my input and produces the next state. Okay, and I have my output function. So this is some logic, some combinational logic, right, that implements the next function. This is my output function that takes my current state and produces the output. Okay. So this is now the Mealy machine, also very fundamental model. You should all know it. So again, there's a set of states, finite, an initial state, input symbols, in this case there are two symbols, 0 and 1. Output symbols, in this case, they are also 0 and 1. Now, the output function, what changes?
It'll be a function from state and input to output.
Correct. So it's not a function just from a state to an output, but from a state and a given input to an output. Right? And the transition function remains the same. So given a state and given an input, I move to some next step. Now, you should notice that here, these two functions are mixed in the diagram. In principle, these two functions are separate. So when I read this diagram, so what does this transition tell me here, for example? Well, it tells me that if I am at state S1 and I read input 0, then I produce output 1 and I move to state S2, right? So this transition here tells me two things. It tells me that my output function at state S1 and for input 0 is 1, gives me 1, right? It also tells me that my next function at state S1 and for input 0 takes me to state S2. But no one says that I have to call these two functions simultaneously, right? You see what I'm trying to say here? So maybe if I give you the circuit view, you will this will become clearer. So this is the circuit for milli machines, right? So the only difference is that now output takes out logic takes also the input as input, right? So not just the current state, but also the current input. Now, what happens if my clock is very slow, right? And in between two ticks of the clock, the input changes multiple times. What will happen? I mean, physically, what will happen if I have a circuit that does that? Sorry? The output will change too, right? Right? I mean, if I'm changing this input, there's some logic here. There's some hardware that propagates eventually these changes to the output. Suppose the clock doesn't come, like for 1 year. Okay? So the output will change, and that's fine. This is what my milli machine model tells me, that you can stay at the same state as long as you want. If you're changing your input, the output will change for the same, for a fixed state, right? So that's why I'm saying these two are two separate functions, and you can decide to call them, you know, together and say, okay, now I'm giving you the final input, please change state, which says, okay, now is the tick of the clock. Or you can separate the two. Say the inputs may change multiple times, but when the clock comes, then I call my next function and I change the state. Okay, so you can see that this is not a purely synchronous model of computation. It contains all the information to, you know, to think of it as a synchronous model, but more. So you can also think of it, you know, as having these other effects where there is a synchronous round determined by the clock, but there are other events that can happen in between determined by changes of the input. Okay? So what should I use to model this circuit here? A Moore? Why is it a Moore? Yeah, because all the outputs, if you look at the outputs, they all come out from a flip-flop. So they only depend on the current state.
the control lines are also go through a clock?
What are the control lines? These guys here?
I see.
So the outputs are 0, 1, or 2, or 3, and they all come out from the latches. So it's an instance of this thing, right? So, okay. The output. Right, well, in that case, the output logic is the identity. So it's a wire. So how about this? Can I think of this as a Moore machine or a Mealy machine? Say that again. Does it depend on how I implement the adder? Does it? What would that mean, an adder with a clock? That it's an adder with memory? So suppose I want to think of it not as an implementation, but purely as a specification model, right? In the sense that we said before. So there is a, you know, yn, which is equal to xn over 3 plus xn minus 1 over 3. Plus xn minus 2 over 3. Okay, if you look at this just as an equation, that what do you think of it? As a Moore or as a Mealy model? As Moore? I can't hear you, sorry. Correct. So it is Mealy because there is a direct dependence from input at time n, you know, at cycle n, to output at cycle n. So it's not Moore. If this term was not here, then it would be a Moore. So that's an exercise, how to transform Moore to Mealy machines. And if you do that, you lose something. You don't lose something, you change something drastically. So I will let you figure out what changes when you do this transformation. Okay, so you basically... So every Moore machine is obviously also a Mealy machine, right? It's a special case because the function, the output function of a Mealy machine can choose to ignore the input, and then it's a Moore machine. And this is your question. Is it possible to transform a Mealy machine to a Moore machine? Some people here say no. So you will take this, you will think about this at your leisure, and if you don't know the answer, again, come see me. Okay. So, Moore machines, Mealy machines, everybody should know that who graduates. Now, synchronous block diagrams, okay, everybody who takes this class should know. Another model of synchronous model of computation. This is actually an abstract model that we came up with to capture tools that do exist, and in particular Simulink, right? So and in Simulink you have this notion of blocks, so it's a graphical modeling environment, right? So you have a library of blocks and you drag and drop blocks from your library to some graphical environment, and you connect them. Every block has a set of input ports, set of output ports, so you can connect them with each other. And then there is hierarchy. So you can encapsulate a diagram into a composite block, and then store it in your library, and drag this whole composite block and connect it with others, and build a hierarchy of blocks in that way. Now, often in Simulink, it's not a purely synchronous model. So Simulink has a very large piece of it is continuous time. So you can, you know, simulate differential equations. You have integrators and blocks of that nature. But there is also a very important part, which is discrete time. And this is usually your controller. So what you will be doing in Simulink, if you were an engineer that designs a control algorithm for an airplane or something, you would, you know, model your physical environment in continuous time, design your controller in discrete time, and simulate the two to see that, you know, the closed loop system is stable or something. Then you would take your controller and try to implement it in software. So the or hardware. The controller part is discrete time, so you can think of it again as a synchronous model. And this is how it would look in Simulink. So we already saw an example of a block diagram, the FIR filter. So never mind that this is a square and this is a triangle and this is a round. So this is still three types of blocks. And as you said before, I can write it as a single equation or multiple equations where I factor out the state. So this becomes now more clear. What is the output at time n, or round n? What is the input round n? And what is the state? So there are two state variables, S1 and S2, and how the output is a function of the current input and the current state. And how the state is updated. So how they say the next state is a function of the current input and the current state. Okay, so this is a Mealy machine again. This is the output function and this is the state, the next function. Okay? This is very clear now that this is a Mealy machine. If I write it in this equivalent form. Now, like I said, a very important feature in synchronous block diagrams is hierarchy. So if I take two blocks and I connect them, I form a diagram, then I can encapsulate them. I build another block P, a composite block which is refined into the connection of A and B, and then I can even hide the internals and treat this block P just as any other block. So connect it further and further and so on. So this is the fundamental modularity concept for this language, right? Just as C++ and Java and so on have the concept of class and objects and so on as a modularity concept, you know, which allows you to isolate yourself from the external world. So here you have this notion of composite blocks that allow you to build more larger and larger and more complex models by hiding some internal detail. Now, this hierarchical model is actually interesting. It's interesting when you try to define its semantics as a synchronous model. And here's the question for you. Can we define, so suppose we have this language of hierarchical block diagram, right? Can we define the semantics of this language, in particular of a composite block, so a block that is refined as a Mealy machine? And if we can, what would be, you know, the output and the next function?
So it seems to me that without the notion of a clock ticking, that a synchronous diagram cannot capture that behavior.
What do you mean without the notion of clock ticking? So I mean, if I there is no explicit clock in this diagram here, right? Yet I still think of it as a synchronous model, right? So I still think of the input at time n, the output at time n, and here is some special blocks that tell me about state, and I can still write, I can still look at this and interpret it as a Mealy machine.
There's no explicit notion of a clock in the diagram, but the equation which you said represents it is continuous time, and the diagram is discrete time. So there is.
Hold on. Why is this continuous time? Why do you?
So normally when the notation that I'm used to asking people use parentheses, they mean continuous time.
Oh, I see.
The bracket,
that was not the that was not my intention here. So by n, I still mean discrete time.
Okay.
So this is a problem of notation. My intention putting parentheses instead of brackets was not to imply continuous time. So this is still a synchronous model. You can think of it as discrete time. I prefer to think of it as a logical time or untimed model, where there is this conceptual notion of round, not really related to time. But you can also think of it as discrete time if you want. So actually, perhaps the question is a bit misleading. The problem is not Mealy or Moore machine. So the problem I'm trying to get at here is something different. And maybe I should just go ahead with it. So look at this model here. So there is a composite block P, right, that has two inputs and two outputs. And if you look inside, it contains two sub-blocks, A and B. And, the first input is connected to the sub-block A, which produces the output, and the second input is connected to sub-block B, which produces the output. Okay? So now, I can think of this thing as a Mealy machine, right? Yes, the outputs at time n depend on the inputs at time n. How? Well, and let's just think of this as having no state, just a single state machine for the moment, just a combinational circuit if you want. So to compute the outputs at time n, I will have to compute the first output by calling the output function of the first Mealy machine, sub Mealy machine, right, A. And to compute the second output, I have to call the output function of the second sub Mealy machine, right? So it would appear that, yes, I mean, this is a Mealy machine, it's just a composition of these two Mealy machines. And I can still describe it with an output function. So this is the, programming form, this is the definition of the output function for P, given the output functions of A and B. Okay, that's all I'm doing here. Now the problem when I try to do this, however, is when I try to use this block P later on in some context, in particular when I try to use it with feedback loop. So suppose I'm connecting this output now to this input. What happens? Sorry? Y2 and X1 is the same domain? Let's assume that the type checking goes through here. Yeah, they're the same type. It's not a type problem I'm trying to illustrate here.
Well, it looks like you just basically made like the critical path longer.
That's right.
It's in fact clear that there's actually like a causality problem.
There is no causality problem. You're absolutely right here. So if I flatten this diagram, I could have drawn it differently. All I've done is taken the output of B and connected it to the input of A, right? So there is no causality problem here. However, because of the fact that I don't know the internal details of P, I have hidden them away. Now I'm reasoning of P as a single Mealy machine with a single output function, right? So it's as if I'm thinking of P as just one block that has two inputs, two outputs, and a single output function that produces both outputs if you give it both inputs. Now, if I try to connect it like that, I have a causality problem. Because in order to call this function, p.out, I need to know both the inputs, right?
Mm-hmm.
But the first input is equal to my output, my second output, so I cannot call this function. So I have a dependency cycle here. And the reason I have a dependency cycle is because I chose to represent this block P with a single output function. So that's my message here, that for hierarchy, and I call this monolithic semantics, right? So if you think of your Mealy machine as having one output function, then it, in general, this will create problems in composition, and in particular in feedback composition. So what's the solution? Well, the solution is very simple. You just generalize your Mealy machine to have multiple output functions instead of just one. Okay, so in this particular case, P will have two output functions. I call them p.out1 and p.out2. The first one will take the first input and produce the first output, and the second one will take the second input and produce the second output.
But mustn't you add a restriction that these outputs are both generated at the same cycle?
This is implicit in your model, right? So just as the same, the notion of cycle was implicit in the definition of the Mealy machine to begin with, that, you know, the output function, you call it whenever you call the next function and so on. So remember, we discussed that. You can call the output function many times within a cycle if you want to, with different inputs, and then you have a not purely synchronous semantics where the inputs can change multiple times within a cycle. Right? So this is implicit in the representation of the model. You can choose to do it only once or multiple times. But the point is that in order to preserve the input-output dependencies of the hierarchical model, in general, you will need multiple output functions and not just one. This is all I'm trying to say here, right? So this is just a very simple generalization of Mealy machines, if you want, to capture hierarchical models. Okay, so you can, again, I'm going a bit fast here, but come see me if you have questions. This is a syntactic problem, right? How do you choose to represent these functions if you want to do it with a state transition diagram? This is a good enough representation. So the way we are doing it in our work, this is our representation, and we synthesize automatically from this thing. So we synthesize this function from the graphical representation. But you know, you can choose to have other representations. You had a question?
Well, yeah, I mean, I was just going to say that essentially before you were outputting an ordered pair, and now you're outputting an ordered pair, the difference is in really the type of your output function. It's really the same. So, like, if you wanted to do this, I'm trying to think if you could just do it by showing. Yeah, I think you should just be able to show.
This is a problem of decoupling the outputs, right? So this tells you that this output does not depend on that input.
Yeah, well actually,
that is the information that this thing here captures, yeah. Right? So when you write a single output function, you think that all the outputs depend on all the inputs. That's not the case.
Right.
So what multiple output functions allow you to do, they allow you to say that, you know what, this output only depends on that input.
Sure.
And this output only depends on that input. So that's why I separate the two.
Because here we've used a couple of the inputs.
In that case. Now, you may have more complex examples. So if you have something like that, so here you have three inputs, x1, x2, x3, and two outputs. How many interface functions do you need for this? So let's say that this is again a composite block, and you want to look at it as a millimachine, right? P. How many functions do you need? Somebody said three. Who said three?
Well, right now I think you only need one.
One?
What?
Okay.
I said three.
You said three. One. Somebody said one. Other suggestions? So if some, who said two? He said two. Good. So okay, if I have only one, don't I have the same problem as here?
Well,
does this output?
From only one, you can return an ordered pair. This makes explicit the
what
fact
do you mean?
That out one depends on in one, which is why we gain something by decoupling.
Right. So if I group everything into one function, then I have created some false input output dependencies here, right? Does y two depend on x one?
Oh well, yeah.
Well, I don't know if I need to know, because later on maybe I will decide to connect it in that way. And if I do so, then indeed I find a problem with the monolithic code. So I'm not saying that the monolithic code is bad. I'm just saying that if you choose to go with the monolithic representation, you may have problems later on if you try to do feedback connection. So one is not good. What about two? So two is good, right? So two is actually good. And two, you would do this decomposition here. Right? So in particular, you will have one output function, out one, that takes as input what? X1 and X2. And produces as output y1, right? And you'll have another function here that takes as input y. Say that louder.
2 and 3.
X2 and x3. And produces as output y2. So you see that x2 is shared here, right? But that's okay. Some inputs may be needed for more than one function. But the point is that the outputs are separate again. Okay, so this is actually an interesting topic, though. If you want to go further, just, you know, come see me. But let's move ahead. Lustre. I won't spend much time on it. It's a synchronous language developed in Grenoble, in the lab where I took my PhD from. So this is how it looks. You define, so this is how the filter that we had before would, this is how you would write it in Lustre. So you would say, I have a node, FIR, that takes as input X, which is of type real, and returns as output Y, which is also of type real. It has two internal variables, S1 and S2, so these are the state variables. And this is, so you simply just write the millimachine that we saw before, the output function, so y is equal to x over 3 plus s1 over 3 plus s2 over 3, and s1 is initially 0, and from then on equal to the previous value of x. So you have this pre-operator here, which takes you back one cycle. And S2 is initially zero, and from then on equal to the previous value of S1. Okay? So, very simple, very elegant, and just one operator. Well, this is also the initial at 2. So really, there's only two operators here that this language introduces, the pre, so to refer to, well, corresponding to the last here, to the unit delay, and the initialization operator, this arrow to initialize the registers. Now, I'm playing with the slides here. What I did here is I swapped the two equations. So I swapped the order. Have I changed my program by doing that? No. So this is just, you know, writing mathematical equations, and the order in which I write them doesn't matter. So this is a property of Lustre. Right? You're just writing equations over the current previous values of your variables. So the order in which you write these equations doesn't matter. And you could also get rid of the intermediate variables altogether and just write everything in one equation. You know that y is equal to x over 3 plus 0 followed by the previous value of x, and again everything over 3, right? Yeah, so this can get very long. That's why you wouldn't like to write it in that way. But I'm just saying you could. And this program is equivalent to that one. Right? So these two programs are equivalent. Yep. There was a question? You can introduce hierarchy. I don't have an example in my slide, by calling other nodes. So when you build a node, you can call it. So you can build another node and say, you know, say write something like z equals FIR of w, right? So you will be instantiating node FIR. It's equivalent to inlining. So it's as if you have, you know, you flattened everything.
So all the statement here is going parallel.
That's right.
No,
it's equations. That's right. Yeah, it's a data flow language. I mean, it's a signal flow language.
So do you have a choice of making a sequential sort of assignment?
For this, you will have to use Esterel. So
okay.
Esterel is a more not in Lustre. There is no assignment. There is no sequence statement in Lustre. There is no assignment. I mean, there is the equal sign, which is equation, right? So
yeah.
Left hand side equals to right hand side. But it's not. Yes.
So how do you do the feedback, like the IR yn minus 1? The yn plus yn minus 1 equals to x.
So how do you do feedback? Yes. How do I implement? Here's an exercise. How do I implement a counter in Lustre? A counter. I start from an integer counter. Yeah. Okay. Let's do it with the state variable. Okay. So you tell me, and I will write the Lustre program that implements a counter. You should be able to do it, by the way. Can you do
three y?
Yes, you can.
Okay, that's not
then, okay, then go for it. Say that again. Tell me how to implement a counter in Lustre. Okay, forget the node. Just give me the equation.
Okay, so the input is action type real, or action type n, and it returns
okay.
Y type n.
Okay.
And you have last
equals what?
You want to take the input and add one.
Well, does the counter have an input?
Let's start from zero, and then the next one is
one plus three.
And the next one is?
1 plus 3, 1.
Good. So it starts from zero, and then it's 3y plus 1. Can you read it? Is it big enough? Okay. So that's a counter in Lucer. If you want to see it more clearly, I could spread it in a state variable, right? So no, it would be the same actually. So I have nothing to do for the state. The equation would be the same. So
yeah.
Y is both the output and the state.
Right. If there's no input, then Y has to be state.
Correct. Correct.
Right.
It's both the output and the state. I'm just saying that the output function here is trivial.
Right.
It's the identity. The next function is this one. Okay. So good. So SRL, I'm only going to do one slide just to give you a flavor how it looks. So SRL is again another synchronous language developed by Gerard Berry and other people. It has an imperative flavor, so contrary to Lustre. Here, the semicolon means sequence, like in C. So you have modules, okay, and they have input and output. These are events or signals, they are called, I think, in SRL. And some of them take values, some of them don't. So in this case, X and Y are signals that take values of type double. And you would write something like, I'm looping forever. I await event X to come. And then I emit event Y with what value? With this value here, you know, X over 3 plus whatever. And what is S1 and S2? They are variables that are initialized to 0, and they are updated like that. S2 is equal to S1, and S1 or S2 gets assigned to S1, and S1 assignment X, right? So this looks more like the control loop that we saw at the beginning, right? Remember that? While, through, do, wait, compute outputs and read inputs and so on. And in contrast with Lustre, the order here matters, right? So if I change this assignment here and I swap these two statements, I will be in trouble. Because now I'm updating variable S1 and then variable S2. So I'm not updating my state correctly, right? Because this gets executed before that. So really, I'm not doing justice to SRL by showing you this example. It's a beautiful language, but it takes 3 lectures maybe to really present the essence of it. So just give you a flavor here. Okay, so it's 12:30. Do you have flexibility or not? You have class afterwards. So I really didn't get to some other interesting things, but I don't know. We can do it another time, or just, you know, I let you read the slides, and if you're interested, come see me. Okay. So you will think about Moore and Mealy machines and transformations at home. Other questions? Okay, thank you then. You're welcome.